the headlines. Iraq's prime minister suspended cabinet sessions and supporters of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr stormed the Republican palace shortly after he announced his withdrawal from politics. Iran's president says a settlement of safeguards issues between Tehran and the UN nuclear agency is one of the conditions for reaching a deal on reviving the JCPOA. And Pakistani officials say a third of the country has gone underwater following monsoon floods that have killed more than 1,060 people so far.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr says that he is quitting politics and closing his institutions, a decision which could further heighten tensions amid months of political deadlock in the country.
I decided to withdraw from the political process so as not to be involved with the corrupt politicians, neither in this world nor the hereafter.
Sadr has slammed other Iraqi leaders for not heeding to his calls for reform. He did not elaborate on the closure of his offices, but he said that some of his cultural and religious institutions would remain open. The announcement has thrown the country into turmoil. Sadr's supporters have broken into the government headquarters in Baghdad, prompting suspension of cabinet sessions until further notice. Tear gas was fired and sounds of gunshots were also heard in the city. Two have been killed and 20 others injured in the clash as the army has imposed a curfew in the capital. Iraq has been without a government or head of state for months. Last parliamentary election saw an alliance led by Sadr winning most of the seats, but he failed to form a government. Also, Ebrahim Raisi, the Iranian president, has reiterated the country's demands in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
What have been raised are first assuring guarantees. Second, the verification of the sanctions removal in an objective and practical manner. Third, the removal of sanctions in a meaningful and sustainable way. And fourth, an end to what I call political accusations regarding safeguard issues.
Raisi said an agreement on the JCPOA revival hinges on the settlement of safeguards issues between Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Raisi also called the safeguards accusations against Iran baseless and politically motivated. The IAEA recently asked Iran to provide explanations for what it called traces of enriched uranium at some of its undeclared sites. Tehran has urged the agency to abandon such accusations that often come from Israeli regime. In his presser in Tehran, Raisi also asked to comment on Israel's recent threats that it won't be bound by the JCPOA revival agreement and will continue to do everything to prevent Iran from attaining nuclear capabilities. The Iranian president said that the regime can never hinder Iran's progress in the nuclear field.
The Zionist regime's threats against Iran have led to nowhere. The assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists was meant to stop Iran's progress in the nuclear field, but we were not stopped. Many acts of sabotage and seditions were aimed at stopping us, but we were not stopped. And no measure by the Zionist regime and the arrogant powers will stop Iran from its right to obtain nuclear energy.
Raisi said Iran will not allow Israel to take any measures against the country if the regime decides to do so. He said Israel has proved that it is too weak to protect itself, even from besieged Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Elsewhere in his remarks, Raisi said there is no plan for him to meet U.S. President Joe Biden when he visits the U.S. next month to attend the UN General Assembly. He said such a meeting is of no use for the Iranian government or the nation. Earlier, academic and political scientist Mahmoud Sadegh Tajar joined us from Qom. He told us that U.S. policies are made in Israel and not in Washington.
One thing everybody in the world knows is that it seems that the American policy is designed in Tel Aviv, not in Washington. That's why what they are planning. Every time Americans want to make peace and improve the relation with Iran, and the Israelis are deciding otherwise. The beautiful thing is in Iran, the decision is made inside the country, but in America, the decision is made in Israel for Americans. As long as they will not decide independently. Remember with Trump several years ago, we had the agreement, but very unethically, immorally, they broke their agreement, and that's what has happened. Decision for Iranians to work on science has no limit, and we have to do our best. But as far as the nuclear cases is concerned, we have been always saying that we have no such a decision for bomb or like that. But unfortunately, it seems that the Americans cannot decide without Israeli permission. So that's the problem.
A third of Pakistan has gone underwater following rain-triggered floods that devastated the whole country last week. Pakistan's Minister for Climate Change says the flooding has created a crisis of, quote, unimaginable proportions. A huge relief operation is currently underway, with the government declaring a national emergency. The National Disaster Management Authority has reported over 1,100 monsoon flood-related deaths since June. Last week, historic rains devastated four main provinces, with Baluchistan being the hardest hit. Officials say the floods have destroyed more than 2 million acres of crops, thousands of kilometers of roads, and dozens of bridges. Over 33 million people have been affected. Officials say this year's floods are the worst on record. The government has appealed for international help to deal with the disaster. Afghan women's rights activists have opened a library in Kabul. The initiative aims to promote reading and provide an educational space for women who have been excluded from public life since the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in August last year. Rahmatullah Bakhban reports.
Afghan women have been struggling for their rights under the Taliban rule. Recently, they have launched this cultural spot under the name of Women's Library. There are more than 2,000 books in this library. Women and girls can borrow books or enjoy reading them here. Meanwhile, the founders of the library say this place offers plenty more than just books.
Our aim for setting up this library is to provide teenage girls with a place to study, communicate, and receive an education. Our second goal is to provide a cultural spot for those women who have lost their jobs and have nothing to do. You know that today many Afghan women are literate and don't accept forced isolation at their homes.
Mitra Kakar, a student of 11th grade, was banned from attending her school when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in August last year. She visits such places to study books, practice drawing, and hang out with friends.
It has been almost a year since we were left out of school. When the Taliban came to power, we were told not to attend our classes. Since then, I have been going through tough times, but I never quit receiving my education. I got an English class and started learning drawings. I also love books and libraries like this. I just hope our school reopens and I can make it to the university. I want to study fine arts.
This place is also becoming a stage for women to speak out. One of the women rights activists here told us that the Afghan women are facing a rollback on their rights since the Taliban's return to power.
If we look through history, Afghanistan has had many prominent, creative, and leading women in different arenas. But since we live under the Taliban rule, it looks like this chain is unfortunately being broken, with women being sidelined or disappearing from active social life. We will keep raising our voices and defend our rights. Neither Islam nor Afghan culture has barred women from getting an education or going to work.
Afghan women rights activists also call on the global community to take serious and practical steps for women rights in Afghanistan. They say that merely condemnations can't relieve their pain, but the international community needs to come forward to press the Taliban to change their stance and uphold the rights of women and girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The U.S. says it is accelerating production of high-mobility rocket systems, HIMARS, to supply them to Ukraine to help it fight with Russia. That is while Moscow has repeatedly warned that the arming of Ukraine adds fuel to the fire and prolongs the war. This is what we discussed in our news review program earlier. Let's take a listen.
That's news review time. The United States is accelerating production of high-mobility rocket systems, HIMARS, to supply them to Ukraine to help it fight Russia, and that according to a senior Pentagon official. William LaPlante made the announcement after visiting Lockheed Martin, a key U.S. arms manufacturing company. He said Washington's goal is to help Ukraine defend itself against the Russian aggression. Lockheed Martin tweeted that it takes pride in delivering products that enable America's mission success. On Wednesday, President Joe Biden also announced that he is sending an additional $3 billion in military aid to Kyiv. The latest package pushes the total amount of military assistance Washington has offered to Kyiv since February to nearly $14 billion. Moscow has repeatedly warned that arming of Ukraine adds fuel to the fire and prolongs the war. To get some insight, let's invite a couple of guests. Barry Grossman is a political analyst. He's in Bali, Indonesia. Emmanuel Pasrais, president of Asia Institute in Seoul. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. So, Barry, adding fuel to the fire and prolonging the war, is this the goal that the U.S. is pursuing, as the Kremlin is claiming?
Well, I think it's been clear from the beginning the U.S. has a very big investment in keeping the conflict going in the Ukraine and accelerating the conflict. All as part of its long-range strategy or tactic of isolating Russia. Certainly, this is a war which the Ukraine cannot win. It's a bit like the mouse that roared. And while with military aid to the tune of countless billions from Atlantic world countries, it can slow the process of losing this conflict down, it can't win. And of course, the Atlantic world's man in Kyiv is completely opposed to any kind of a political resolution. Bearing in mind that when the failing Soviet Union, soon to be Russia, agreed to grant independence to the Ukraine, it did so on the basis of the Ukraine signing an agreement committing to being a neutral party. And of course, it's been anything but neutral in recent years as the U.S. agenda plays out, which first gave us the maiden protests and the civil unrest that followed, and eventually civic unrest throughout the eastern provinces where they're predominantly populated by ethnic Russians. So this particular president of the Ukraine, apart from being corrupt, is very committed to pushing the U.S. agenda, which is to keep this conflict alive, this military conflict, at the expense of Ukrainians. I don't think short-range missiles are going to make a great deal of difference in terms of the eventual outcome of this war, even a great deal of tactical difference in the short term, because whatever the Ukraine can do with U.S., British, and wider Atlantic world help, the Russians are more than capable of doing with their own armor.
Now, Emmanuel, U.S. Has so far, as I just mentioned, contributed $14 billion, okay, worth of military armament to Kyiv, and now they it looks like that they're adamant to keep doing that. Okay, we see Lockheed Martin and other arms, you know, people are in the arms business. They are making big bucks. No, right. The U.S. is benefiting from this, and especially arms manufacturers. What about European countries? Are they not losing? Look at the energy prices, cost of living in the U.K. and others.
Well, obviously, for the average person in Europe, or for that matter in the Ukraine, things are quite severe in terms of the impact, not just in energy, but in food prices. Ukraine itself is a major food producer. And in some ways, all these multinational corporations were most interested, actually, in the food production in Ukraine. And the situation is not getting better. Europe is reaching a state it hasn't seen, really, in some ways, since the 1950s. And that's a global impact. In the Ukraine specifically, the impact has been devastating. And there, as you noted, there's no end in sight. And for all we can see, Lockheed Martin is gung-ho about increasing conflict, selling more weapons, and trying to engage Russia in what could potentially be a world war or a nuclear war.
Okay, thank you so much for your comments. Bera Grossman in Indonesia and Emmanuel Pasraj in Seoul.
Ukraine says it has launched a, quote, de-occupation campaign to retake the southern region of Kherson from Russian troops. A local government official says Ukrainian forces had launched a powerful artillery attack on Russian positions in the area. Russia-installed officials say that the city of Novaya Kokhova in the Kherson region is evacuating civilians due to constant artillery attacks by Ukrainian forces. Russia rapidly captured swaths of Ukraine in the south near the Black Sea coast, including the city of Kherson, in the early phases of the war. In the north, a regional governor said that the Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, was hit with cluster munitions. No casualties were immediately reported, but in the east, Ukrainian military say that 8 civilians were killed when Russian forces shelled the Donetsk region. Moscow says it does not target civilians.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh, I slept a lot. I have to get up. Time for breakfast and a new beautiful summer day in Kashan. Thank God I can make tea in an old Iranian teapot and samovar here. Hi, Mom. I'm fine, thanks. Actually, I've resided in the famous Amiri Ha house. For today, I'm going to visit the traditional bazaar of Kashan. Thank you. Bye-bye. The historical Kashan Bazaar is one of the must-see attractions of the city of Kashan and also one of the most significant traditional bazaars of Iran that will amaze visitors with its artistic architecture and nostalgic atmosphere. Just like other traditional bazaars of Iran that are considered as the main elements of the city's old texture, the roofed Kashan Bazaar is surrounded with other historical monuments of the city like old mosques, caravanserais, abambar or water cisterns, covering an area known as the city's old district. This bazaar dates back to the Buyid and Seljuqid eras. It started booming during the Safavid era, and what is remained is a bazaar which is built on the remains of the old bazaar during the Qajarid era. This bazaar is registered in Iran National Heritage List. Time to go. Yes, I'm going to visit the Bazaar of Kashan today. But I'm afraid it's not possible to visit the entire bazaar in just half a day. Kashan is a very special city, full of old stunning sights. So, here it is. Good. Not a long way to go. Oh, God. Look at the city. I'm crazy about these adobe-made walls. This city looks like a history book. I'm excited. decided to visit this bazaar. It said this bazaar has been one of the most important trade centers of the past until today. Well, I am now at the traditional bazaar of Kashan. Wow. Just from the entrance of this bazaar, you can guess this market is an Iranian Islamic architectural masterpiece. The architecture and main structure of this bazaar looks like all bazaars of Iran. This bazaar constitutes different sections like Raste, Sara, Timche, and Chahar Sogh. I am now in Mianchal Chahar Sogh. Well, it has old wooden gates. You may not believe, but this Chahar Sogh is one of the most beautiful sections of this market. Here I am in Aminodole Timche. This part of the bazaar is the old section of the bazaar. The entrance of Aminodole Timche has tile works. This section is surrounded by old wooden windows and old bricks. This part of the bazaar has astonishing architecture. Most of the carpet selling stores are in this Timche. Here we have the copper market, one of the attractive sections of the bazaar, in my opinion. Yes, the familiar sound of hammers on copper. I may buy these cooking wares. Oh, very beautiful. Good souvenirs. Well, art is long and time is short. Of course, the traditional bazaar of Kashan is more than what I described for you, but I have to come back to Tehran before night. In the future, I may come back here to see the details of this astonishing bazaar of beautiful Iran. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Respected brothers and sisters, we've gathered here for the commemoration of the Shahada of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. May Allah reward you all. And now today we get a chance to, inshallah, look at the topic that we've chosen, which is leading a lifestyle of Imam Hussein, or leading a Husseini life. So tonight, inshallah, I want to talk about lifestyle and the importance of lifestyle. Now, in order to discuss this topic, I wanted to start out with a couple of examples from the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We have Abdullah, who's also Abdullah al-Kalbi. He was a very brave warrior, and it's very interesting. His story is similar to Zuhair ibn Qayn. And I'm giving these stories because, again, they give us some insight into who these people were. How were they living their lives in order to be able to give their lives in such a way? So Abdullah, they say that he actually came across the army of Kufans who were going to Karbala to basically martyr, you know, to kill Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He came across them, just he was journeying. You know, back then it wasn't the case that like the news was spreading so fast, everyone knew everything. Right? So he comes to them and he says, "What are you guys doing?" And they tell him, "Oh, you know, this is the story. You know, Sayyidina Ali has refused to give the bay'ah. And so we've been ordered by the governor to go and kill him. The Khalifa has given the order to the governor and we're following orders, so we're gonna go kill him." So look at what he says. He says that, you know, "I have been passionate about this idea of being able to battle with the mushrikeen. And now I see that there's this army here that's going to, with the purpose of killing the grandson of the Prophet. Now, if I compare the two, in my opinion, being able to fight against those who want to kill the grandson of the Prophet is more valuable than even being able to battle against the mushrikeen." So what does he do at that point? He goes to his wife and he begins to speak with her. And he says that, "Look, at this opportunity has come to me. What do you think about it?" And then she says that, "Let's go. I wouldn't be happy with anything but joining you in this journey." And they just walk away. And you know, when we talk about the state of intizar, of being readily awaiting the coming of the Imam, being anticipating that opportunity to really show when we're tested, here we see this example of muntadirin, those who are truly awaiting. And my question again is this, that what kind of dynamics were present between the husband Abdullah and his wife so that they work together to be able to attain this type of success? It's very beautiful. And we see then that in Karbala we have these companions who have been assembled not randomly, not just because, let's say, they come from, you know, noble lineages of like generations after generations of Muslims or supporters of the Ahlul Bayt. No, they came from different backgrounds. But there was something about the way they conducted their lives that gave them that honor of being able to give their lives as shuhada. So with that, brothers and sisters, I want to focus on this topic of lifestyle. Lifestyle is a word which apparently it's not something that was always used. It wasn't a concept that was always present. Now it's pretty common. You know, lifestyles, the people, different people live different lifestyles. But apparently it was something that came about, I believe, in the 1930s. Why? Because before that time, society wasn't so diverse. You had people who would be living in their towns, in their regions. They would have their own cultures. They would have their own food. They would have their own rituals, traditions. And there wasn't so much globalization taking place. Everyone had their own sort of thing, their own language, their own customs. But what happened is that after the Industrial Revolution, post-industrial, now you had a lot of movement of people. And you had immigration taking place. You had the development of subcultures within cultures. And these subcultures are bringing their own customs, their own traditions, and now you have this, you know, sort of flow of different cultures that are coming together. Now, which one is going to become dominant? Which one is going to be integrated? Which one is going to be subordinate? And then you have the development of lifestyles. Allah Ta'ala in Surah Al-Furqan, towards the end of the surah, He has the description of His ibad, His special servants. You know the verse, Allah says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وعباد الرحمن الذين يمشون على الأرض هونا وإذا خاطبهم الجاهلون قالوا سلاما. Who are the ibad al-Rahman? Who are the special servants of the Most Merciful God? They are the ones who, when they walk on the earth, they do so in a humble manner. And when the ignorant address them, they deal with them in a way which is free of any defects. They deal with them in an honorable way. They do things in a proper manner. And then in Surah Al-Furqan, Allah describes different qualities of these ibad al-Rahman. The way they spend, the way they have a balance in their lives, what they stand for, what they don't stand for, how they are with their families, what du'as they make, what they aspire towards in their life, and various different things. And if you ask yourself, okay, well, these qualities that are being described there, you know, they are very deep sort of aspects of the way that somebody would lead their lives. And in one hadith, Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, what does he say? He says that, it's reported that he said regarding the first verse, Yamshuna ala al-ardi hawna, he says that when they walk, they do so in a manner which is according to the way that they've been created. Ala jibillatihim, like the way that is according to their fitrah. They've been created in a certain way, not arrogantly, not making a big show of things. Now, walking, of course, is more than just the way that we move from one place to another when we're just using our feet. Walking is about the way we move, the way we do, the way we like sort of go from point A to point B. It relates to a lot of what we do. And if you think about life as a general, it's a journey. So the way we go through this journey, according to this ayah, according to the riwayah, the hadith, it is supposed to be marked with a type of humility. Now this is something which is giving us direction about how to lead our lives. It's part of a lifestyle. We have other instructions in this regard. I'll give you an example. There's a tradition where Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam is speaking and he says to his Shia. Now at that time, you know, they were living in a society where they were a minority. And he tells them that, you know, some of the responsibilities that you have is that you should be seen praying in the masajid. You know, make sure that your presence is known in the general population. Because the masajid at that time were the places where everyone gathered, whether they be followers of the Ahlul Bayt, whether they be Shias or whether they be others, the masajid were public places. Go and make sure that you've seen them. When one of their funerals takes place, make sure you go and participate. When they get sick, then you go and visit them. And then he says something very interesting. He says that when one of you becomes renowned, when you become known for qualities like Sidqul Hadith, like being truthful in your speech, when you become renowned for being somebody who's trustworthy, when you become renowned for Husnul Khulq Ma'an Nas, when people see that you, when you deal with people, you deal with them in the perfect behavior, and you have a good cheer when you deal with others. Then what is he says that فَيَسُرُّنِي, it is a cause of my pleasure that you should be known as Ja'afari. That you should be known as people who are associated with Ja'far. And that people should say that هَذَا أَدَبُ Ja'far. This is the way that Ja'far alayhi salam leads his life. This is the way he conducts himself. We see that in his followers. This hadith is very inspirational, brothers and sisters. Because again, it talks to us about, you know, you want to be a follower of the Imam. You're here in these majalis of Imam Hussein. Well, how can you lead a Husseini lifestyle? How can you live a Ja'fari lifestyle? How can you live a Fatimi lifestyle? How can you lead a Mahdawi lifestyle? And so on and so forth.
Swear to Allah, whenever I face troubles in my life, I close my eyes and see your shrine and call the back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime's ongoing war against the Palestinians aims to extinguish their spirit of resistance, but they have become even more steadfast in their fight for justice and liberation, says Sami Al-Aryan, writer, in an article published under the heading Zionist regime attacks, Western collusion, and the high price of Palestinian freedom. Stay tuned for more. On the morning of Friday, August 5th, 5-year-old Ala Qadoum woke up in her Shajaiya home in the center of Gaza, excited that her grandfather would be coming to take her to buy a new school uniform and backpack. She had been dreaming of that day all summer ahead of her first day of kindergarten in just a few weeks. But before Ala could set out on her shopping trip, her home was hit by an Israeli regime airstrike. She was killed instantly. In Rafah, in the south of Gaza, Abir Harb, a 24-year-old student studying information technology, went to visit her fiancé, 30-year-old Ismail Dawig, to go over wedding plans. Ismail, who looked after his elderly mother, owned a small business he had been hoping to grow in order to provide for expanding family. Abir was very happy that day because Ismail had phoned her father for permission to set a wedding date, but the meeting never happened. A day later, Ismail's body was recovered from the under the rubble of his home. He was found tightly hugging his mother as their house was obliterated by an Israeli regime missile. On the same day, in the Jabalia refugee camp in north of Gaza, Najwa Abu Hamda was not prepared for the devastating news she was about to receive. Her 19-year-old son, Khalil, had been killed in an airstrike. Just that morning, Najwa, who struggled for 15 years before having her only child
through fertilization, told neighbors that she and her husband hoped Khalil would get married soon and bless them with grandchildren. Their hopes for the future are irrevocably destroyed by this unimaginable loss. In the Bourajji refugee camp in the east of Gaza, 45-year-old Sheikh Yasser tried to soothe his three children as the terrifying hum of Israeli regime warplanes hovered above. Within a few minutes, however, the judicial officer and part-time religious teacher, his 13-year-old twins Muhammad and Dalia, and his 9-year-old son Ahmad were incinerated by an Israeli regime missile. Only Yasser's mother and wife survived. The next day, on August 6, in the Jabalia refugee camp, 11-year-old Rahaf Soleiman stepped out of her house at around sunset to call out to her brother to come home for dinner. Without any warning, she was hit by a Zionist regime missile, causing the tiny girl to lose her right hand and both legs. Regardless of which part of Gaza one lived, 45 Palestinians, half of whom were women and children, were killed. In those 55 hours of hell, more than 360 others were injured and maimed because of the Zionist regime's appetite to punish, target, and subjugate Palestinians in Gaza. The Zionist regime's military aggression began that morning with an unprovoked targeted assassination of a commander of Islamic Jihad, one of the main Palestinian resistance groups. The use of violence has long been a tactic by Israeli regime leaders in the midst of their election campaigns for political gain. Shimon Peres tried it during his political campaign in April 1996. When the Zionist regime committed the Kano massacre, killing more than 100 children. As he was launching his re-election campaign, Ehud Olmert waged a devastating three-week war on Gaza in December 2008, which claimed the lives of 1,400 Palestinians, including nearly 500 women and children, with thousands more injured. In May 2021, as Benjamin Netanyahu was preparing for his own re-election bid after several inconclusive elections, he unleashed the full force of the Israeli regime killing machine for 12 days on Gaza, resulting in more than 260 Palestinians killed and thousands more injured, and thousands of homes, buildings, and businesses destroyed. Similarly, the war this month was an attempt by the current Israeli regime leaders, Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz, to gain political ground over right-wing opposition leader Netanyahu before heading to the polls in November. Interestingly enough, all Israeli regime leaders mentioned lost their re-election bids after none of these military campaigns managed to achieve their goal of vanquishing the enemy and gaining a decisive victory. But what has been consistent throughout the Zionist regime's vicious wars is Western leaders' callous mantra that Israel has the right to defend itself, ruthlessly giving the fake regime of Israel a license to kill any Palestinian it perceives as a threat or an obstacle to its designs. By colluding with the fabricated regime of Israel, Western governments have been sending an unmistakable message that Palestinian lives are expendable. Freedom and human rights do not matter. The rule of law, democratic values, justice and equality are selective, and security and peace are not universal guarantees. Yet Palestinians are not oblivious to the tremendous sacrifices they have endured against the assault of the Zionist regime for decades. Palestinians mourn every victim and cry over every child. There is not a Palestinian home that is not scarred by a tragedy of a loved one killed, maimed, injured, arrested, or imprisoned, or a home demolished, bombed, or razed, a land confiscated, or a tree uprooted. Each time the Zionist regime launches an attack on Palestinians, it aims to extinguish their spirit of resistance and pressure them to give up their rights. But in the face of such brutality and disregard for human life, the people become even more determined and steadfast in their fight for justice and freedom. Sooner or later, the world will recognize that the path of ignoring the plight of millions of people by supporting a settler colonialist project and arming it with superior military power against children, mothers, young brides and grooms, and ordinary people is immoral and unsustainable. Conscientious people across the world know that as well, as Nelson Mandela had once observed. We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
The people's presence is the foundation. When we recite words remembering Allah in a group, the effects and blessings of it descend upon the group. In the Quran, it is stated that, "For admonition indeed benefits the faithful." The Quran, Surah 51, verse 55. Everyone benefits from it, Yes, even when you pray the night prayer in solitude in your room, the Almighty Allah will still bestow its benefits on you. But here, during the Friday prayer, this benefit is a public benefit. Everyone benefits from it. Or consider the verse, "Remember me and I will remember you." The Quran, Surah 2, verse 152. "I will remember you." This special grace from God is a result of dhikr. Dhikr here is remembering God in a group. So the grace that is granted is for the whole group. Or, "And remember Allah greatly so that you may be felicitous." The Quran, Surah 8, verse 45. And many of the verses that are in the Quran. I referred to Al-Mu'jam Al-Mufahras, Quranic Index. And these few verses came to mind for now, which I've written down. If you search, there are plenty of verses that talk about the blessings that dhikr brings. This is one feature, the collective remembrance of Allah and its blessings.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The next feature is the continuity of this event, these weekly meetings. Well, the Hajj pilgrimage is once in a person's lifetime. That's how it usually is. But this Friday prayer is a weekly event. This is very important. As far as I am aware, and I've done some research on this, there is no other spiritual gathering in any religion, in any place, where the people of a city or a large group of people in a city gather in a central place together on a weekly basis. What the content of this gathering should be constitutes the next issue. This is a very important feature. This is where the excellence of this gathering becomes evident, even in comparison to Hajj. It takes place one week after another. This week, next week, the week after that, and so on. Well, this is an example of what we read in Dua Kumail, "So that my works and litanies may all be a single litany, and my occupation with your service everlasting." It's continuous. It's not a matter of being there one day and absent the next, or being present in one place but not being present somewhere else. I need to be continually at your service, and my occupation with your service everlasting. This is how this weekly gathering is. This is how my occupation with your service everlasting can be carried out.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.